You're listening to the Animation Addicts Podcast, episode 245, Oliver and Company, Boombox Dancing Legs.
Welcome to the Animation Addicts Podcast with the Rotoscopers, the number one place to get your animation fix with animation addicts just like you. Each episode, we dive into the wonderful world of animation featuring Disney, DreamWorks, Pixar, and everything in between. From hilarious discussions and movie reviews to interviews with industry insiders, this show's mission is to brighten your day through our love of animation. So hop on your nerdy couch, grab some snacks, and get ready to hang out with your animation besties because it's time to dive into today's episode.
Hey there, animation addicts. I'm your host, Morgan Stradling.
And I'm Chelsea Robson.
So, Chelsea, if you were a dog, what sort of dog would you be?
I would actually be a Doberman because I love Dobermans. But according to this video or this movie, Dobermans are the worst.
Oh, this movie forever ingrained my love of Dobermans. I know they're supposed to be bad guys, but they were so cool and they are so amazing that you can't just overlook that. I'm sorry. They're bad. They're awesome. They have the pointy ears, which you need to do for it to be a proper Doberman. Dock the ears, dock the tail, right? Speaking of thoroughbreds, we are the Rotoscopers. We are animation addicts through and through. And today's episode, let's just jump right into it. This is a very unexpected one. Chelsea and I needed to record, and some of the movies that we want to record, we need some guests. We need some additional information and research. And so Chelsea said, hey, let's watch this one. And I said, let's do it. Gotta love Disney Plus. We threw it on and here we are. So without further ado, let's travel back in time to the 80s for Oliver and Company.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pie, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecasts.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Have to say that I have a core memory of that boombox. The guy, the legs with the boombox. It's a core memory. You cannot get rid of it out of my mind. It's there solidly.
Good old boombox legs. Love it.
I also wanted to say, like, at the very beginning of this movie, you just notice it's so 80s.
Very 80s.
So let's talk about that.
If a Goofy movie was 90s, this is oh so 80s.
Yes.
So before we talk about it, let's set the stage for how this movie came to be. So the studio was Walt Disney Animation Studios. Director was George Scribner. Release date, it was a winter release. Remember, we used to do Catch and Fire and say winter releases or summer releases. This was November 18th, 1988, 1 year before The Little Mermaid. Budget, $31 million. So we're getting into the late 80s where these budgets are getting bigger and bigger and bigger.
Mm-hmm.
And the box office total over $121 million. Now, its an initial run, it was $53 million. So basically doubled its budget. And this was actually released the same day as Land Before Time, which I think is wild. Because, you know, at this point, the Nine Old Men had retired in the early 80s. And then there was the big Don Bluth leaving the studio, starting his own studio, all that drama that happened. And so, and then this is the very first movie of the Eisner Katzenberg era that they had officially greenlit when they came together, ran, you know, took the studio over. So this is like the beginning of an era, not the end of an era. And so it's interesting because, you know, it's just hilarious to me how it works sometimes where it's like, you know what? Yeah, I remember that guy who left our studio. We're going to release our movie the same day as his. How about that?
That's crazy.
Which that was not his first one. Obviously, there was Secret of Nim, and he was very well known at this point in time. So came out the same day as Land Before Time. Land Before Time opened number one with $7.5 million compared to Oliver and Company's $4 million. However, Oliver and Company went on to have a better theatrical run with $53 million compared to Land Before Time's $46 million. At the end of the day, they're both pretty successful, I would say.
What was interesting is right after this is when you have Dom DeLuise, who basically like jumped on over to the Don Bluth side and he's their guy, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And so as I'm listening to this and I'm hearing Fagin, and I'm just like, it's Dom DeLuise. It's itchy.
There's actually a lot of really great voice actors in this movie. So we will talk about them. Let's just go ahead and talk about them. So before we do, this movie obviously is based on Charles Dickens' classic novel, Oliver Twist. Now, normally this would be Morgan's literary segment where I have read the book and then I tell you about the book and compare the differences and whatnot. Now, I did not have time to do that because honestly, we had just decided on this movie a few hours ago. I did not have time to speed read Oliver and Company, but I can't, or Oliver Twist. But I can give you the basics. I have read it before and seen Oliver, the musical, and different movie adaptations. I feel like this is a pretty well-known property at this point. Very classic, very beloved, right? So Oliver Twist is about a boy named Oliver who is an orphan in London. He's an orphan until he's about 9 years old. And then one day he's just at this horrible orphanage that no one would want to live at.
I want some more.
Yes. And he has some boys at the orphanage who really kind of try to goad him on, and they get him to go ask for more food, which, you know, you just have your gruel and that's it. He obviously gets kicked out after this point. Now he's on his own. So when he's out on the streets, he meets a little boy named Jack Dawkins, who we know as the Artful Dodger. This is a boy that's his own age, and he offers him shelter in his home with their benefactor named Fagin. Fagin, you know, turns out is a career criminal who trains all these orphan boys to go and to pickpocket for a living. And so, of course, Oliver, just being very naive and innocent, he ends up doing this, and they go on one of these pickpocketing missions, and they steal a handkerchief from an old gentleman. And Oliver realizes this. He's horrified. He runs off, and he basically gets caught, you know, and this man, it was named Mr. Brownlow. It was his handkerchief who was stolen. He sees that Oliver is sick. He's very feverish. He takes him home. He nurses him back to health. And he just really sees that there's some sort of resemblance with this boy. You know, and of course, Oliver loves it here. He thrives in this man's home. You know, he's not associating with the criminals anymore. And it turns out that Bill Sykes, who's another member of Fagin's gang, and Sykes's lover, Nancy, they say, no, this isn't going to happen. So they capture Oliver and they take him back to Fagin. So in this version, Fagin is kind of the big guy, the overlord. So then they have Oliver again do more burglary, and, you know, he has to go back to the house and have to steal from there. And it just ends up not being really great. Obviously, Oliver really wants to, you know, go back to this, but he doesn't want to steal from him, but he's kind of like stuck in this weird situation. So there's another lady, her name is Mrs. Maley. She has an adopted niece named Rose. So Nancy, who again was the lover of like the bad guys, right? She meets up with Rose and lets her know of Fagin's plans, basically to steal from him and everything. And Sykes finds out and he murders Nancy, and then he flees. Sykes is gone. Yeah, so he has a guilty conscience, and an angry mob follows him, and he accidentally hangs himself while he's trying to escape this. No good. But basically, at the end of Oliver Twist, Mr. Brownlow reunites with Oliver and adopts him as his son, and, you know, they live a happy, happy existence in the countryside from there. So that is just kind of the loose Oliver Twist, the basics of the story, and you can see how it is loosely based. You can see how Oliver Twist is loosely based on this. There's some similarities, but there really isn't. And, you know, so we're going to go through each one of these characters and we'll discuss them, you know, in their movie counterpart and their book counterpart and things we liked and didn't like. So first, before we even get started with that, let's talk about where it's set, which is London versus New York City.
The concrete jungle versus...
another concrete jungle.
Yeah.
The modern concrete jungle versus the older one.
Exactly.
Yeah. And, you know, they wanted to modernize this basically when they were pitching the movie. They're like, hey, how about Oliver Twist with dogs? And I think Katzenberg was interested in doing an Oliver Twist revamp at a different studio. So he was like, yeah, of course, this sounds great. So that got the green light. And it was just kind of a way for them to modernize the story. And, you know, what better place than New York City? Now, what I think is really interesting is there's always all this drama online that you read about, like, why hasn't Disney gone in and deleted the Twin Towers? I'm like, why should they? Why would we want to erase this part of our history?
That's
the fact
weird.
That it existed is a good thing. It's not, oh, we need to shield the children from knowing about these two buildings in the background that they didn't know existed. Like, what? It makes no sense to me when people are
that's
like, oh,
weird.
We got to remove the Twin Towers from movies like they never existed. You know, for example, Home Alone 2, he's up at the top of one of them. And I don't agree with that. I don't believe in erasing history. I don't understand why it's offensive to see the Twin Towers there. Obviously, it was horrible what happened. But yeah, not a fan. But yeah, this was actually
like
one of the very first.
That's more of a reason to keep them.
Right. You would think, right? But people on the internet be as people on the internet be. They want some crazy things.
Gosh. They do want crazy things.
And this was one of the first Disney movies to have sort of product placement, if you will. Now, there wasn't any official, you know, product placement pitches. You know, it's not like Kodak paid them money or USA Today. They really just wanted to make it very real to New York City. So they're like, hey, like you can't go to New York City and not see the Coca-Cola billboard in Times Square. So we're going to include it. So very modern in that way where it had these references to, you could say kind of, it dates it a bit. Some of these are not around anymore, like Kodak. Well, Kodak's,
it's
more of a super niche brand, but you get what I'm saying. Anyway, so... Yeah. I actually, for this movie, I like that it is done in New York City because we have seen quite a few movies in London. You know, the one right before this was The Great Mouse Detective. And there's been quite a few movies done in London. Even, you know, our other canine film, 101 Dalmatians, right?
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I like London as well.
Right.
I have nothing against London.
New York City is just cool. It's just cool. I don't think the New York City Tourism Commission was involved. It's like, hey, we need to change our image. Come on, make it seem cool. I mean, they make it seem very New York. It's grungy. It's gritty.
Yeah.
It's busy. It's a metropolitan. It's a metropolis. I think it's very true to what it is at the time. Like it's not this like sparkly clean Emerald City, you know. Not even
right. It's not Disneyland.
It kind of reminds me. There were certain moments where I kind of got "We're Back" vibes.
Yes,
you know Jenny, how she's the kind of like. No, she's not like an orphan, but she has these parents that are just too busy to even be around with her. We'll talk about her. Yeah. So before we do that, let's talk about Oliver. So in this movie, Oliver is equivalent to Oliver, right? Oliver Twist. They're both orphans. They both end up kind of getting into a gang. And other than that, that's kind of the differences. I mean, although can you really make an Oliver Twist film without the classic, please, sir, can I have some more?
I mean, yeah, I was missing
that. Big missed opportunity to include that somehow, right? Like, even if he would have done it at Jenny's house and he scarfs up all the food and then he like says it to get more, that would have been a funny kind of just little reference there, totally out of order.
Or even at the very beginning when he's getting the hot dogs, you know?
Mm-hmm.
He's like, hey, can I have some more?
Right. And speaking at the very beginning, I thought it was, I don't know, not very realistic. It's like the free kittens. And the intro of this is just actually
so sad.
Pretty nice. Yeah, it's so sad.
It was
great. It just has the music that just like hits you as soon as we start. It has classic Disney rain. Like, what else do you want in a Disney film where there's a thunderstorm that just makes things super sad, right? But I just don't buy that Oliver was the last kitten there. First off, he is the only orange one, which is a very highly desired color. And you're telling
this
me these gray kittens were taken over him? Mm-mm. Yeah, not necessarily buying that. So I feel like he's so adorable looking. They should have made him like really ugly looking or something to make it seem a little more believable. But whatever. Hey,
But then we wouldn't be as sad that he was totally left and the people who were trying to sell him didn't even care and was just like, all right, you know, fend for yourself. Take it.
You know what they need? Like, they need to do a remake of this and to have Puss in Boots play Oliver with the big, sad kitty eyes.
Oh my gosh.
It'd be perfect, right?
With a Spanish accent and everything. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yes. Oh, goodness. That would make my day, actually.
Yes, right. Okay, so a few other characters. In this one, there's Bill Sykes, and then there's Bill Sykes in Oliver Twist. Now, the only difference is the way that they spell Sykes. Sykes in the original is with an I, and Sykes in this one is with a Y. Why they felt they needed to do that, I don't know. Like, come on, you're basically doing the same name. Can we? Maybe they just want to make it like, this is a Disney character. So we can copyright
him. This is ours.
Yes. So we can.
Exactly.
Yes. Put him in the parks, I guess.
As I was listening, I was like, this voice sounds so familiar. And then I realized, I'm like, it's Percival C. McLeach.
I love it.
It is. Once you go back and listen, you're like, oh, yeah.
You're like, I cannot hear that. There's a few characters like that. Speaking of Oliver, his voice was voiced by Joey Lawrence. And once you hear that, you're like, oh, right?
Yeah, you really, yes.
A younger one, obviously. This is before the Boy Meets World era. But, you know, he was just a wee one at the time. So
he still gets it on with the voiceover crew, you know?
Good for him.
It's
a good gig.
Yeah.
If you can get in, right? So Fagin, obviously, in this version, Sykes is like the big bad overlord. And he has the two Dobermans, mm-hmm. Roscoe and DeSoto. And then Fagin is just kind of the wormy pickpocket dude who is in over his head with too much money that he's owing to Sykes. I liked that. I liked the way they were able to change the storyline a bit. Initially, the way that this movie was going to go, it was going to be about Oliver's parents getting killed and then seeking revenge for their death. Like, they get killed at the beginning.
Okay.
I think by Sykes was one of the ones who's like killed the parents. So it was like, oh, wow, that's really dark.
Yeah.
That's a bit Black Cauldron
Adding
dark.
Revenge.
Yeah, this is his revenge mission. Like, wow, okay. So, how do you like Fagin in this version where he's just, even at the very end, when he thinks he has this brilliant idea to pay back the money and he's like, I'm going to kidnap the girl or I'm going to kidnap the cat and then this millionaire is going to pay me so much money for my kitten. And then he sees that it's the girl, Jenny.
Well, I mean, the fact that it's Don DeLuise, like his mannerism in voice is very endearing. And so it's hard not to like him.
Mm-hmm.
And granted, like, he's the type of guy that I wouldn't really like. If I just saw you on the side of the street, I probably wouldn't be like, hey, we should be friends. But the fact that he's just like so in way over his head.
For sure. His design, I really like. And so we were talking about how there was this new wave of animators who kind of cut their teeth in the 80s. And there were other ones like Glenn Keane, which we've talked about, Mark Henn, Ruben Aquino, Mike Gabriel. So speaking of Glenn Keane, he was the supervising animator for quite a few people in this film. So Sykes, mm-hmm. Georgette, Fagin, and Jenny Foxworth. And what I want you to do is just to type in Glenn Keane, Oliver and Company, and then look at the images section and you will see, oh my gosh, some of the most beautiful character sketches of these characters. So like particularly Fagin and Jenny, I love, there's so much motion and just, you, if you know Glenn Keane, you know the way that he is able to draw these characters and really make you connect with them. So these mm-hmm. model sheets are so beautiful, and I will share some in the show notes, but I saw that and I was like, oh my gosh, how come, like, I can see Glenn Keane's hand in the final product, but these sketches are even more of his design. You know, obviously they had to tweak it so it matched the style of the film and whatnot, but it's, they're so nice. I like them a lot. So anyway, going back to that. So I guess we've talked about her enough. I want to talk about Jenny, but we should talk about the other dogs first, right? So we have Artful Dodger versus Dodger. You know, in Oliver Twist, Artful Dodger is more of a peer, right?
Mm-hmm.
He's the same age, kind of. He's maybe like an older boy.
Artful Dodger's definitely more older.
He feels like an adult, yeah. Like a grown up, and he's also a different species. So that's one thing that's totally different mm-hmm. is that everyone is dogs. And then Oliver is the sole cat who's trying to figure it out, right? I always remember growing up loving this movie and loving all of the dogs. I just thought every yeah. single one of them was great.
Yeah, they all have a very specific personality. They do a really good job of characterizing them and giving them even like Francis, not Francis. Frankie, Francis. You know, yes. It's like these little things like really stick with you as you are going back and remembering them. What was funny is like I'm thinking back and the main people that I remember, like at least the main names that I remember is definitely mm-hmm. Georgette. You can't forget her.
Oh, yes.
And mm-hmm. you can't forget Oliver, obviously. And then Sykes. Like, mm-hmm. Those were the ones that really made the biggest, like, impact on me name-wise. Like, I can always remember right. their names. But all the other names, I was like, what were their names again?
Yeah, same here. When I was watching, I was like, oh, yeah, his name's Francis. Oh, Tito. Oh, Einstein. Mm-hmm. And then the girl was right. Rita, who's the only girl dog.
Yeah, it's a fun crew, and they did a really good job of.
They're all super unique and kind of fit into their own little box. So we have Cheech from Cheech and Chong. He's Tito, mm-hmm. which he's also one of the hyenas
Alonzo.
In Lion King. Yes, that's so funny. Ignacio Alonso Julio Frederico de Tito. Oh, that's great. There's Einstein. He's the gray Great Dane, and he's not particularly bright. But he's cute. And I guess there is a stereotype that Great Danes are not very smart. They're a bit dim-witted.
They're really big, not.
They're brawny. Yeah.
Uh-huh. And he does his job in running into cars.
Yes. That plays his part well,
he's
right?
He's an overachiever.
Francis. He's the English bulldog. He loves art, theater, Shakespeare, TV, obsessed. And he does not appreciate being called Frankie. So, and then of course there's Rita, who's just kind of like a mutt type of dog. I don't know. She's the girl.
Yeah, I don't know what she is, but like you like her. And yeah. she's also like
she's
the more
nice.
Mature of them all. You know, it was kind of like had a vibe that it was going to be her and Dodger that were apparently the couple. Like, or mm-hmm. at least that's how it comes across, especially after they bring Oliver back home or back to their place. And she's like, we really shouldn't have done this, Dodge, you know? And he was just like, mm-hmm, whatever. Mm-hmm. But I always kind of got that vibe. And I felt like they just did a really good job of making them all very unique and noticeable and memorable. Even though, like, I'm sitting here saying that I can't remember their names. It doesn't mean that I don't remember the dogs. I remember.
Yes.
you remember.
Good point. We've been talking about Jenny. I always want to call her Penny, but it's Jenny. What is more 80s than the name Jenny? Am I right? And she's basically the equivalent of Mr. Brownlow. She, in her own right, is a bit of an orphan. Her parents have an extended trip, you know, kind of a work trip where they have to go to a conference in Europe. And so she's just alone. And she has the butler who's kind of, you know, his name is Winston. So he just helps out. And when I was watching some of the very first scenes with Winston, I was like, oh my gosh, that is Watson from the Great Mouse Detective. Like, there were certain moments where I was like, wow, someone animated you too. That doesn't make sense. Someone animated you too.
Yeah, No, yeah.
You know what I mean? Like,
I totally don't.
It's not the same person. But
I know that style.
Yeah. If I could bet money that whoever did Winston also did Watson.
Yeah.
Man, these British guys.
It's like when you know it. That was something that I miss about 2D animation is the fact that there was a style to each character because mm-hmm. of the person that actually drew them. With CGI, it's so much easier for people to interchange and just jump in and animate somebody because somebody's already mm-hmm. built the character and designed it. And so it's not like you can have a major change. But like when we talked about how in Great Mouse Detective, you've got Ratigan, and then in Fox and the Hound, I just remember that there was this moment where I was like, oh, Glenn Keane did the bear at the end of Fox and the Hound. And then at the very end of the Ratigan moment where he changes, I'm like, no, that's Glenn Keane. That's Glenn Keane doing an animal crazy. And I was right. And I was like, ah, that's so cool. That was something that you can actually look up and see. One other thing that I thought was funny was there's a moment where Oliver gets chased by a bunch of random dogs that they don't, you know, they're just the beginning dogs. And it is I would almost bet that it was rotoscoped from A Lady and the Tramp.
Oh, there were some moments where I was like, I feel like I've seen this before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And a good old trusty showed up, made a cameo. So,
okay. So going back to Winston really fast, I was looking him up to see, I was trying to see who his animator was. And normally you can find it, but I could not as a quick, you know, 30-second Google search, but I did come across his Wikia page basically. And this is not Disney Wikia. This is hero.fandom.com wiki. So Heroes Wiki, which I think this is an interesting place to put him. I would not consider him a hero as in the, because if you look at the banner of this website, it's all superheroes. So yeah, someone said, no, Winston is a hero. Anyways, they have like a little, they have a category for him and he is labeled as do-gooder. And there's this photo of him like tipping his cap at you. And his occupation is the Foxworth's butler. He's a driver. He's Georgette and Oliver's caretaker. And my favorite section is powers/skills. And it says, no information.
He is a boxing fan.
He is. That's what it says. It says hobbies. Watching ring meetings on TV. I guess that's boxing matches are called ring meetings. Yes. His enemies are Bill Sykes and Roscoe and DeSoto. Mm-hmm. So in case you're wondering. And the type of hero that he is listed as is butler. He's the butler hero.
Oh. It's just
him and Alfred.
Him and Alfred. Oh, great. I kind of feel like Francis is his enemy, though, because he has way more back and forth with Francis than mm-hmm. he did with mm-hmm. any of the other dogs.
So I went on this page. Sorry, I'm like really going down this rabbit hole to see like when was this created? And it seems someone decided in November 5th, 2020, that this person named Adiazi, they decided that, hey, this person needed... Winston needed his own page on the Hero Wikia. And then over the course of the next few days, this person went in and created more and more and more. They added a whole bunch of stuff. And so no one got a few touches in 2021. But as of basically 2 weeks ago, someone else went in there and added more things. Oh, the internet.
Internet people are amazing.
Never change.
Please. Oh, goodness. I'm really glad that they added in Georgette because she wasn't in the book. And so to have her added in here was a good touch.
Yeah. So basically the equivalent maybe would be Rose, but she's like she's like the niece. She's like really kind and sweet. And Georgette is not. Georgette sees Oliver as a threat. She doesn't like him. As soon as Oliver's gone, she's dumping his bowl in the trash. So I guess kind of similar, but really not really in the least. Other than the fact that, hey, when he goes to this rich person's house, there's a woman there. So there we go.
Yeah.
Yeah. Jenny's kind of the equivalent of Mr. Brownlow, except for she's just a little girl, which it works better. Although what I will say, since we just did our Disney, the best Disney dates, nerdy couch discussion, which you should totally check out, rotoscopers.com/243 for that discussion. We rank all the Disney dates. Now, Jenny and Oliver, they go on quite the day through New York City, Central Park. They have...
They wave at the old people.
Yes. that is a core memory as well. Like, she's like being a goofball, dancing around, and the old people are looking at her like, ugh. And then she does a curtsy, and Oliver does his little bow, and they're like, oh, they're cool. They're one of us. And they let them go on their way.
Oh my gosh. Yes. they definitely are looking at her as though she's like nothing but trouble. But it's like, oh gosh, like,
right. I mean, and you kind of get the feeling that she's just allowed to roam free and do whatever she wants. Yeah. But then every few scenes they show that no, Winston, he's there. Our hero, yeah. Winston.
Alfred in disguise.
Yes.
So next would be Nancy, which is one that was cut.
Yeah, I guess Nancy would be the equivalent of Mutt Dog, who we can never remember her name, Rita. I think Rita's kind of the equivalent of Nancy because she is very kind to him. She's one of the bad, or quote, you know, not bad. She's just the scoundrel.
Bad influence.
Thieves. Yes, exactly. Mm-hmm. She's the gang. So,
yeah.
But she's the goodie. But all of them are good. That's the thing. We never get the impression that like any of Artful Dodger and Fagin's crew are evil. They really wanted to separate that. And that's why I think they made Sykes the boss with the bad dogs, right?
Yeah. And that was what was funny about Roscoe and DeSoto. It was just the fact that even though they are meant to be the villains, they're our favorites. They were amazing. I love them. And I love their collars. And I always wanted to get a collar that would like kind of go down the chest like that. But those, they don't work. Like they defeat the purpose of a collar on a dog.
So, Chelsea, you are burying the lead here, burying the bone. You were a Doberman owner.
Yeah, Princess, yes. We had Princess, and then we got into breeding for a little bit, and so we've done the Doberman breeding game. One from her litter we had was Duchess, and so we had Duchess for a little bit, and then, unfortunately, I did not live in a place that was very conducive to having a lot of animals that would try to run away. We lived on a very busy street, and so it was a sad day. I grew up with lots of bad memories. We'll walk past that for a second.
I'm sorry for bringing it up.
All dogs go to heaven. It's okay. But I love Dobermans, and Princess was my dog. I had her for almost 6 years. Which is great. Do you remember Princess?
I do. She was for the first few years that we were friends. You had her.
Yeah.
But Dobermans to me are the epitome of rich guard dog. Like I have my estate, I have my manor, and I have my not one, but two Dobermans to guard the premises.
You have to.
And they will bite and they will attack you if you try to get on. And so this again is one of my goals is I will have two Dobermans on my grand estate.
So there are actually four different colors of Dobermans. And if you start looking them up, this is just a nice little tangent time for us, Doberman tangent time. There are four different colors. There is the classic black, and next is the red, which is more of a brown but still has the same markings. But there is also a blue Doberman, which is kind of more of it looks more gray. And then you can also find albino Dobermans. You definitely don't want to breed an albino dog, but they just look so cool and I want one. So
an albino Doberman?
I would love to have an albino Doberman, yes. I would actually love to have all of them. I want to have like one of each because it's like they look so cool and to have all of them, it just seems cool.
I would like black. Black
you're,
with the
you're
brown.
Going for the classic.
The
black.
Classic. The classic. Like if you're going to buy a Chanel purse, you got to get the black one for your first one. You're not getting the crazy yellow color. Okay. It's a big investment.
That's true.
Only when you're on your, you know, fifth or something do you go crazy and you get the lemon yellow Prada bag, right? Okay, so now let's talk about, I mean, we got to talk about her, right? Georgette. She's voiced and sung by the great Bette Midler.
Bette Midler.
And
which, okay, here's a funny thing. At the end of that, I felt like it was weird that she got last billing on the credits. And I'm thinking, is that a thing that's like better in some way because you're last? Because it's only a very short cast.
So yeah, well, sometimes when they do movies, they do like starring this person and this person. And then at the very end, they say with blah, blah, blah. Like, you know what I'm talking about?
Right.
I'm going to look this up right now. Okay, let me see if I can. Good old Quora is helping us figure this out. So this is from Philip Mayer. He seems to have professional experience in film and TV, a BA, MFN cinema production from USC. Sounds like a pro. So let's listen to what he says. Among the leads, that's mostly specified and worked out in their contracts. If you have two actors of equal stature, you will often see their names appearing together on screen with one taking the upper right and one taking the lower left. So that way they can appear to have equal billing. End credits are easier and will state order of appearance listed alphabetically. I'm more interested in the beginning part of that where it's like starring this and this. And at the very end, they'll have like a big name at the very end. And it's usually with, but that's very hard to search the word with. Okay. Here we go. Phil Romano, a TV director, he said, what's the difference between an opening credit designation starring actor on a TV show and the designation with? The actor credit with is used when a well-known actor is not a leading character and negotiates being the last actor credit, but is singled out by using the with. This calls attention to them. Okay, since they are in every episode, they can't use the special guest star type of credit. So it seems that if you're not necessarily a huge lead role, you're not the main character, but you are such a big name that you deserve prominent attention, they'll throw you at the end with the with designation.
All right.
So there you go. So now we know.
Now we know.
Do, 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 do. You know what that is?
Yeah.
The more you know.
The more you know sign.
So Georgette is great. And speaking of core memories, I have a very distinct core memory of that moment where Georgette is sitting on her vanity. She's scared because the other dogs are coming in and she thinks that they're going to take her and it's wobbling back and forth and it eventually breaks. That is a core memory. And another core memory is Jenny mixing the cat food with that brown batter. And there's the chunks of food in it that look like Cocoa Puffs. Very, very distinct memory of that. Like as soon as I saw it, I was like, oh my gosh. It's very just funny distinct. The things that you hone in on when you're a kid.
Yeah,
those two were definitely some of them.
Well, and also the point where Georgette is sitting on the couch doing her jazzercise exercise.
Yes, and the jazzercise to the human tape. And then when it's time to leave, she hits it with her foot super fast. That's a core memory where it's like, just like the animation of that. Like,
so
I'm sure
weird.
Glenn Keane was involved in like,
I'm sure. Oh, that's amazing. And
I mean, of course, obviously he was involved. I'm pretty sure there wasn't a scene or even a frame that did not pass his eyes.
Probably.
But it's just such a funny character moment of the turn off the TV.
Yeah. And then you also have so many of these audio memories. I mean, all these quotes, and they all go back to those commercials that they would put at the very beginning of the VHS.
Yes.
So it's like a pussycat. As the movie went on and these little moments happen, I'm like, oh, that's from the commercial.
That's
good times.
To be a 90s kid.
Right. But all of these things like go down into like, okay, what was our core memories and first thoughts and experiences for this film? I mean, it's hard to even say. I don't remember. I was too young to remember seeing it in theaters, but I definitely own the VHS and watched it a lot of times. So I have very specific memories of watching this over and over and over. The Dobermans as well. It was just funny going back and watching this. I was like, why have I not wanted to watch this in a while?
I felt the same way. But watching it, it was very enjoyable.
Yeah.
And I remember why I did. I mean, I say like, oh, I grew up watching this movie. I can't tell you whether I've seen this movie 5 times, 10 times, 20 times. It just like was one of the ones that you would stick in every once in a while. Right.
Yeah.
And so it hasn't been like a huge urge or rush to really review this movie on the podcast. Here we are, episode 245.
We're finally getting
around to it. But as I was watching, I was like, this movie's fun.
Yeah.
It's quick. It's light. There's great character moments. The songs are really, really well done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're classics in their own right. Yeah. Can't go wrong with Billy Joel. Can't go wrong with Bette Midler. Georgette's mm-hmm. song is one of my favorite songs.
Yeah.
Now, would you call Georgette's song a villain song?
I think that's what we decided to put it as, a villain, just okay. because she wasn't necessarily a villain, but she was the foil.
An antagonist.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
I was actually thinking there's the one song that Rita sings. And I was thinking, okay, we are going to be doing a Nerdy Couch discussion on another couple songs that we missed. And one of them is Best Sidekick Song. So would that one be considered a sidekick song?
Georgette?
No, not Georgette. The one with Rita singing, where she's like, ugh. New York is going to be laid with gold or something
is
like that.
Is it a montage in a way?
It wasn't necessarily like a growing up montage.
Yeah, it was just they were traveling the city.
Yeah, it was more of her showing him the ropes.
A sidekick song, huh? I want to ponder that.
We shall ponder. But mm-hmm. I also thought, I know I mentioned that in the best opening songs thing, but as I watched it this time, like most of the time when I went through those lists, I kind of just like listened to the soundtracks, and I didn't watch all of the movies to be able to tell you like what was the better songs. But as I'm watching this movie from the get-go, it's a normal castle that you would remember, the blue, but the music that goes along with it is just like, oh, okay, this is interesting. And it's just goes straight into that opening number and the Once Upon a Time in New York City. And I just felt like I should have given this one more props because it's just, they did a good job with it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I would have it as like a top one, but it's still, you know, it's up there. It should have made a higher list on my list. Wherever it was, it should have been at least one notch higher. It really did a good job of showing you and making Oliver very sympathetic.
Mm-hmm.
Like the fact that like you go from $5 and meow, meow, and then now you're alone and the person doesn't even care enough to stick around to see if anybody's willing to take you. Like just a sign that says free, like this is not okay. And then there's so much rain that the box actually breaks. Like this is, you're like drowning this thing. It was so sad. And I think I remember when Pablo was on how he had just mentioned to us that he had seen this movie recently and how it made him cry. And I was like, oh, I'm almost there. Like, this is sad.
Yeah. No, they do. They did a really great job.
Also, Sykes was somebody, like I mentioned, I remembered him. And even on our last, when we were talking about the best dates, and I was like, I have a core memory of there being a train of some kind mm-hmm. and realizing, oh yeah, the train is where Sykes goes to his death. Like that part is intense.
So yeah, let's talk about the end because, okay, so initially it's like, oh, Fagin, you're just a dummy. You mm-hmm. thought you were going to blackmail and get the cat and get some money and pay your debt, fine, whatever. And this whole time I'm like, Sykes is fine. Like Sykes is just a debt collector. He wants his money back. I have no problem with Sykes. He has aggressive dogs because obviously he runs in shady business and shady circles. So he's got to protect himself. I have no problem with Sykes. I was thinking that. I was like, he's not really that bad of a guy.
I mean, there was the phone call conversations that he's having. Well, you don't kill him at first. You know? We're just like,
well,
okay. But other than that, yeah.
What's a little attempted murder here?
It's between just the a mob. Threat.
But then things get real when he kidnaps Penny himself. He realizes, like, you know what? Forget the cat. Let's get the girl. So he gets the girl, he takes her in, and then crazy chase ensues. And again, I'm like, okay, he's being a weirdo. He's running away with her. But then the part where it just completely goes off the rails, or should I say on the rails, mm-hmm. is when they go onto the subway track. And then Sykes revs his car so fast that the tire, the rubber on the tire disappears and goes away. And now he has He basically anchored himself. Yes, created a train car. But I'm sitting here and I'm like, this is not going to end well. They didn't even try to say that this was like an abandoned track. Like, there will be a train coming.
This is the main train, like bridge.
Yeah. This is just a ticking time bomb. This guy has really gone Cruella de Vil crazy eyes status at this point, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so he's going and then...
The front of his car, how it has two Dobermans leaping forward is perfect. And I want that.
And his license plate is D-O-B-R-M-A-N. Doberman. Yes, it's great.
If somebody has a 3D printer, please build me one of those front of my car things, because I want one.
The two?
Yes. The two jumping Doberman going forward.
If anyone has a 3D printer and can please do that for Chelsea, she would love it ever so much. Okay, great. Yeah, but anyways, it's like, how are you going to get out of this? He's going straight towards the train, and everyone hops off, you know, the very last minute, and he basically crashes head on to the train. Yeah. There's fire and obliteration.
Guy's dead.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. There's no surviving that.
No.
And then.
No.
They are up on their little motorbike a la Darkwing Duck, like going across the suspension cables of the bridge. Do you remember that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the chase scene was pretty intense, and they had a lot of really great use of the CGI. You know, they're really getting inventive with this. I liked it. I felt like the most part, the different CGI that they had used was in areas that did not distract. It was for things that were very architectural. You know, there's that scene where Georgette is walking down the stairs and the stairs behind her are spinning in a very cool way. You know, anything with buildings, cars. I like the use of that. They take that and then essentially rotoscope over it.
Yeah.
Where they then draw the car moving and it creates that nice effect. So that's what they had done Great Mouse Detective the year before. So I may be wrong on that, but I'm pretty sure that's what they did at this point in time. But good stuff.
Good time. I just, you know, going back to this, as we were saying, this is definitely a trip back into the 80s. And even though you and I, we don't remember the 80s, we definitely remember the 90s, though. But it still has a lot of the memories of like coming out of the 80s that we do remember, because this is 88. So it's just fun to kind of see how it goes. And then also back to the core memories. Like this builds up so much of my childhood that I didn't even realize until I watched it again. I was like, oh my gosh, this movie. And saying it once again, I don't know why I didn't want to watch this. Like this was one of those that I haven't watched it in the last 10 years. Like since we started the podcast, I know we did do a review of the DVD, but that was just basically our memories of it when we did a YouTube video about it. And to actually rewatch it again, it's like, wow, cool. This is my childhood. Good times and great oldies.
Cool. 94.5. So with that, any last thoughts about this movie before we wrap it up?
Go ahead and rate it, and I'll tell you what my rating is, because I've been going first the last couple times, and you've been copying me.
I'm such a copycat. Yes. So I think I'm going to rate this 3.5 stars. It's very enjoyable. I didn't have really any problems with it. I liked the characters. The music was good, but not, you know, phenomenally great, where I want to listen to these songs over and over and over again. But they were classics, you know, just because there's been enough time with them that... Yeah, a lot of these are really classics. For example, Georgette's, her song, everything about that scene, again, core memory, is I just love the Georgette scene. Oh, girl, we've got work to do. Pass me the paint and glue. She's such a diva. Mm-hmm. And it's so great because it just goes with the Bette Midler of it all. And the movie has just really great characters. I feel like it's based on source material-ish that also has great characters, but they really just took these characters and just flipped them on their head and gave each character, dog, whoever, distinct personalities and really play that up. And I think it all together, this crew works really well together. It's okay to look at. There's some scenes where everything feels really flat. For example, one of the final scenes where they're on the train tracks, it's the background sky is just like a plain blue. Like there's... It's like they ran out of money or ran out of time on that scene and didn't do a proper background.
They just used the paint.
Yes, it's just a blue background. You know what I mean? So there's moments where it's like, okay, it kind of gives me a feel of Xerox era, but we've moved past that.
Yeah.
And it's not quite it's not quite Caps. It's this weird transition period for the company, but it's the beginning of getting there, you know? So this wasn't the early 80s where those movies were what they were. They're goodish if you grew up with them, right? And they're fine. Yeah. But this is like, we're heading in the right direction, starting with Great Mouse Detective. This one was another hit. And then we're preparing for The Little Mermaid, which I must say, I re-listened to that episode recently and I gave it 4.5 stars. And I was sitting there like, what are you talking about? Yes, I gave it 4.5 stars. And I'm like, why would I not give Little Mermaid 5 stars? What are you talking about, Morgan? So I'm amending the record and giving it 5 stars. Like, what? Anyway, and this one I'm going to give 3 now.
Okay. I'm going to follow you and give it about
copycat.
The same. Copycat on that one. I think the reason why is the fact that I was actually internally against watching this movie for a while. And I didn't understand why. And I still don't understand why. It does have a lot of those elements that you really look forward to in a lot of the full musical songs. But it doesn't have, like, the music itself doesn't. That's not true. Like, I was gonna say it doesn't like bring me back, but I'm like, you know, there's specific songs that totally do, but there are other songs that I felt like were not mailing it in, but just kind of like, yeah, that works.
Right.
So no, I'm gonna give it 4 stars. I'm just gonna go up because I really don't have that many reasons to give it much lower. I don't currently watch it a lot, but I would watch it again. Like right now, I would go back and rewatch it, even though I just watched it. and I can understand why as a kid, I probably watched this 100 times. Mm-hmm. And so I get it. I understand me. So that's kind of why I'm going at that. Also, just a random thought that I didn't talk about is that birthday party scene at the end.
Thoughts on that.
I would never, ever.
Like, the parents aren't even home yet. And obviously that was the thing. Like, oh, you're not going to be here on my birthday? Fine. And yay, you made these new friends and, you know, escaped death together.
You have
together,
no other
but
friends.
But you do not invite the creeper pickpocket dude into your home.
No.
Winston, nope.
And I understand where she was like, oh, he saved my life. No, he put your life in danger. Like, gosh.
I honestly would not have been surprised if they would have done a scene where he, like, as he was leaving, was stealing stuff from, you know, they do the bet and he doesn't have the money. So he skedaddles out of there. But like, I wouldn't be surprised
like
if he was
like 12 fake bulges on his arm, you know?
Yeah. So and the like, Mickey Mouse watch, which is great.
Yeah.
So, that looking back, I'm like, oh, that's not a good look.
That's not
maybe
a good look.
Just the dog should have been there. Cause Fagin, that was weird.
Yeah. Like and it. Have Fagin coming by and picking them up after, you know, like that would have been a much more appropriate birthday party ending.
Right.
Yeah. And it just like, it goes back to like my, you just can't trust somebody missing that many teeth. You just can't. And so like Fagin, I just can't do it. I've got issues with that. Mm-hmm. But other than that.
Great like, points.
it was a great time to watch this. I enjoyed it. And it was a happy, I left happy at the end.
It was just odd that they didn't, did I miss this? They didn't show her reuniting with her family.
Yeah.
Right? Like, you would have thought, like, oh, the big happy family, they finally came back. Doesn't that happen in We're Back?
It does.
She ends up being with the parents, and it's like, oh, okay, like, things are going to be okay from here on out. But the parents were just, it was almost like she was the orphan, which I'm sure they were trying to show that in a way.
Yeah.
How she mirrors Oliver, and they need each other, right? But
They do call, like, oh, you're coming back tomorrow. Oh, she'll be so happy.
Yeah. They would have been so much better if they came home a day early. Like, she's having the birthday party with the dogs, and the parents walk right in, and it's like, oh, because that's
then they
her
have
real
to, like,
family.
They have to, like, talk about why this crazy Fagin is in your room.
No, without Fagin. Okay. Just dogs, no Fagin.
Oh.
Like, oh, wow, you're such a loner girl that you don't have real friends and you're having your own birthday party with some stray mutts. Okay, we need to stop taking trips. We need to be home. We need to be more present.
Yes.
We need to be more present parents. We're sorry. We're going to change this.
Good. Yes. Good times.
Yeah. So
We want to know what you guys think about this movie in the comments. You can also, you can go to rotoscopers.com/240, or is this 245?
245.
Wow. So rotoscopers.com/245, or you can go to Instagram as well. Yes, and you could do both. Go to both and check them out, and you can leave your comments there. Tell us what you thought about this film. What were your core memories? Did you also always think of boombox dancing legs like I do? Because that's just, it cannot be taken from my mind.
Boombox dancing legs. That's our title.
Perfect. All right. Until next time,
we are the Rotoscopers.
I also had a yellow cat for a time. I just remember that this cat was huge and had 7 toes. And so every time I think of Oliver, I think of that cat that I had and would shed a lot.
My sister had a cat. It was an orange cat with stripish, and his name was Popcorn.
Oh, well,
and
nice.
I, from what I've heard, I tormented Popcorn. I always wanted to pet him. But it wasn't like one of those, I mean, that's cats, right? They don't want to be pet.
Right.
So.
Unless they do. And then they enforce their will upon you. My cat she would come and sit down right in front of my mom as she was like working on stuff at her desk. And then she would just like walk over and just lay on her hands and be like, excuse you. You have a job to do. You must pet me. You and me together will be. What did we make that a? Was that a love song? I think that we added that into the love song category.
Did we? I can't even remember. There were so many.
I know.
Plus, we just did them back to back to back to back, so it was just like one giant mush of like every song ever.
And we still didn't even get them all. Perfection. That laugh.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
You've been listening to the Animation Addicts podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, don't forget to subscribe and be sure to leave us a 5-star review. We're available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you want to help spread the word, be sure to share the podcast with your friends on social media. Just don't forget to tag us at Rotoscopers on Instagram and use the hashtag AnimationAddicts. For all the links and full show notes for this episode, go to rotoscopers.com/podcast. Now, if you still can't get enough for your animation fix, be sure to subscribe to us on YouTube and visit rotoscopers.com for more animation news, reviews, and interviews. Thanks for listening.